can foster creativity, innovation, and productivity. How do I sum up paradoxes? With a paradox, hard and good. The final two emotions and experiences that we're going to be taking on in this chapter are irony and sarcasm. I don't love putting these two words together, which is my attempt at sarcasm. I don't like going on the record about knowing the difference between sarcasm and irony because it means I can't defend my clever use of sarcasm by saying, oh, I was just being ironic, which is my attempt at being ironic right now. Irony and sarcasm are forms of communication in which the literal meaning of the words is different, often opposite, from the intended message. In both irony and sarcasm, there may be an element of criticism and humor. However, sarcasm is a particular type of irony in which the underlying message is normally meant to ridicule, tease, or criticize. Now, this was a big definition paragraph. In the book, it's bolded, so I want to read it to you again. I'm going to read it a little bit slower and kind of break it into pieces for you. Both irony and sarcasm are forms of communication in which the literal meaning of the words is different, often opposite, from the intended message. So in both irony and sarcasm, there can be elements of criticism and humor. And here's the big piece to understand, I think. Sarcasm is a particular type of irony. So it seems like irony is the big bucket, and inside of the big bucket is sarcasm. And with sarcasm, the underlying message is normally meant to ridicule, tease, or criticize. This is hard because both irony and sarcasm are easily misunderstood, especially when you're talking to someone you don't know well, and there's already some heightened emotion in the exchange, and it's disastrous when you're emailing and texting. In an overview of neurological findings related to irony and sarcasm, researchers suggest that the successful comprehension of irony depends on the perceiver's ability to infer other people's mental states, thoughts, and feelings. Again, I think that's why it's almost exceptionally difficult to do irony and sarcasm well over text and email. I have a hard don't do it rule. And let me read to you why again, because this is dense. Successful comprehension of irony requires us on the receiver's end to be able to guess or infer what the person being sarcastic or ironic is actually feeling and thinking. And so that makes it tough in person. It makes it almost impossible through technology. Research on intent behind the delivery of sarcastic communication has been mixed, with some studies indicating that sarcasm is intended to soften the blow, and other research showing that sarcasm is intended to be more hurtful than direct criticism. Recipients of sarcastic communication have varying interpretations of intent, which do not always map to the intended meaning. One of the things that I learned early in my work is the developmental requirements for understanding irony and sarcasm. While we sometimes think of our kids as being more than capable of sarcasm, the research tells us that understanding the subtleties of irony and sarcasm is a developmental process that involves the coordination of multiple brain areas. According to Ruth Fillick and her colleagues, quote, children do not seem to distinguish between irony and sarcasm until the age of 9 or 10, when they master second-order mental state reasoning. Another group of researchers finds that, quote, although middle school-age children can correctly discern the sarcastic speaker's meaning and attitude, appreciation of sarcasm's humor develops through adolescence. And the development of full understanding of the nuances of both communication styles, irony and sarcasm, actually continues to develop well into adulthood. I was raised in a family where sarcasm was confused with intellectual ability and craft. When I was a kid, there were too many instances when teasing and sarcasm were too hurtful or went too far or went on for too long. I remember reading when I was pregnant with Ellen, my oldest, that the word sarcasm comes from a Greek word meaning to tear flesh. Steve and I did not do this perfectly, but we did set an intention to watch our use of sarcasm around and with the kids. It can just go wrong so quickly, and it can often end up in shame and tears. However, I'll confess that my dear friend Chaz and I have so much fun with each other while trading ironic and sarcastic comments. When I read that these behaviors can sometimes enhance close relationships and highlight closeness, I wasn't surprised. There's like a ping, ping, ping between just a couple of my friends and I who are just, that's our vibe. I wasn't surprised at this finding that it can highlight closeness. You know, Chaz and I have been friends for more than 30 years, and the verbal sparring is great fun. I actually asked him while I was writing this book why he thinks it works, and we agreed that we're very careful and we don't use sarcasm and irony to express emotions and thoughts that we're afraid to talk about. We have a lot of hard conversations because we're friends for 30 years, but we also work together. And we're very diligent about not weaponizing words. I think sarcasm and irony are reserved for playfulness only. As we leave this chapter, I think the biggest watch out for me, as I think about everything we've been talking about, the biggest watch out for me, especially with irony and sarcasm, is this question. Are you dressing something up in humor that actually requires clarity and honesty? Chapter 6, Places We Go When We're Hurting. Anguish, hopelessness, despair, sadness, and grief. This is a tough chapter, but it's a chapter that to me may be the most important one. It's a chapter that gives words to some of the emotions and experiences that we have the most difficult time naming. And it's funny, since the book has come out, I've received so many emails and, you know, comments on social saying, I had no idea this is what anguish felt like. I didn't know what despair was. Being able to name it has allowed me to talk about it. So I want you to hold in your mind and heart as we go through this chapter that the ability to recognize, label, name is inextricably connected to the ability to move through and heal. We're going to start this chapter looking at anguish, which is maybe one of the toughest emotions in the book, if not the toughest. Renata Suzuki has this beautiful quote about anguish. Let me read it to you. Anguish. It's one of those words you understand the meaning of just by the way it sounds. It has this gnarling rasp to it as you twist your mouth around to say it. Kind of like what feeling it does to your insides. It's an awful, drawn out, knotted up word. It's also one of the things I feel without you. Poets, artists, and writers approach the topic of anguish without apology, often capturing it in a way that leaves us with a sense of shock, heartbreak, and sometimes foreboding. We may not be clear on what we're seeing or reading or hearing, but we are certain that we don't want to move in closer. We don't want to know or relive that emotion, that experience. This painting by August Schenck hangs in the National Gallery of Victoria in Melbourne, Australia. While little is known about its artist, the painting has twice been voted one of the NGV's most popular works, first in 1906, and then again a century later in 2011. You'll be able to see the painting on the PDF that comes with the audiobook, but I'll describe it to you. It is a snowy, bleak day, and there is a sheep, a mom sheep, a mother sheep, surrounded by a murder of crows, standing over her dying ewe, the baby lamb. And it's, I know because I read all about it when I was working on the research, I think it's like 8 feet long. And it's very painful to look at because you can see the anguish in the mother sheep. And it just kind of takes your breath away. What's so interesting is the way Renata Suzuki and her, in the quote that I opened the chapter with, the way that she could capture anguish, the way this painting captures anguish. On the other end of the art and science spectrum, social science researchers seem to steer clear of the concept of anguish altogether. Many study around the construct, while others put it on a continuum that includes less extreme emotions like sadness. Yet, what emerged from my work is that anguish is an emotion and an experience that is singular and must be understood and named, especially for those of us who have experienced it, or will experience it, or may bear witness to it. This is how we define anguish, is an almost unbearable and traumatic swirl of shock, incredulity, grief, and powerlessness. The shock and incredulity can take our breath away, and the grief and powerlessness often come for our hearts and our minds. But anguish, the combination of these experiences, not only takes away our ability to breathe, to feel, and to think, it comes for our bones. Anguish often causes us to physically crumple in on ourselves, literally bringing us to our knees, or forcing us all the way to the ground. The element of powerlessness is what makes anguish traumatic. We are unable to change, reverse, or negotiate what's happened. And even in those situations where we can temporarily reroute anguish with to-do lists and tasks, it finds its way back to us. About 10 years ago, I received a call from someone I love very much. In the span of 90 seconds, they shared that they had spent the night contemplating suicide, then disclosed a major trauma that I did not know anything about, a violence that tore through my memories and reorganized my history and my life. I was standing on a sidewalk outside of my church when I took the call. The kids had run inside to find friends, and Steve was a few feet in front of me watching me after I said, "I wonder why this person is calling so early on a Sunday. I guess I better answer it." As I listened, I dropped my purse so I could brace myself against the wall, clenching my cell phone in the other hand, and actually sliding down the brick wall. Pure anguish. After helping me stagger to the car, Steve got the kids from inside the church and drove me home. And for months, it was a dance of desperate attempts to fix, to change, and help, followed by more anguish, then ultimately I got help. Today, a decade later, I no longer fall to the ground when I think about that call, but it still evokes anguish, and I'll just be really honest, I'm not the same person I was before that call. I'm still me at my core, but it took time and help and processing for my bones to come back, and they're slightly different than they were before. Another example comes from a story that a graduate student named Gabriela shared with me several years ago, when we were talking about my research and the experience of anguish. Gabby told the story of being in high school and spending the weekend helping her best friend Carmen prepare for her quinceanera. A quinceanera is a coming-of-age celebration in many Latinx communities. It's a special milestone for girls who are turning 15. Quince is 15 in Spanish. The celebration often starts with a religious service followed by a party. And these gatherings range from small get-togethers in the girl's home to like huge, elaborate parties in hotel ballrooms. Sometimes there are even courts, which are similar to bridal parties. Gabby and Carmen had been best friends since middle school, and Gabby wanted to be by Carmen's side for what she knew would be an emotional weekend. Carmen's mom had died of ovarian cancer when Carmen was 12. And Gabby told me that she was pretty sure that had it been up to Carmen, she would have skipped the quinceanera, but her family really insisted on it. The night before the celebration, Carmen and Gabby were in Carmen's room, sitting on the bed texting with friends, and they heard a quiet knock on the door. It was Carmen's dad, accompanied by her older brother and her older sister. And Gabby could tell by the look on their faces that something serious was happening. Carmen's father stopped at the door, and her brother and sister kind of gently pushed him past until they were standing just inside the room. Carmen stood up and looked at her father, who had one foot in the room and one foot in the hall. He looked unsure, and this made Carmen visibly nervous. And she looked at him and said, "What is it, Papa?" And he just looked down, and his hands were kind of trembling. and he handed Carmen a wooden box. And Carmen held the box nervously, looking at her father and her siblings. Her sister said, "Open it, Carmen, it's okay." Carmen gave Gabby a knowing look and then opened the box. And in it was the tiara that her mother and her sister had worn at their quinceañeras. Both Carmen and Gabby had been expecting this moment with the tiara, and they both felt relieved that the moment had arrived and that it would soon be over. They had even talked through what to say and how to act with Carmen's father, who Carmen guessed would be in tears. But then, unexpectedly, Carmen's father handed her an envelope, and he could barely speak. He said, "Your mother wrote you this note the week before she died. She wanted you to open it the day before your quinceañera." Carmen grabbed the letter and immediately fell to the floor. Gabby said she just sank and moaned. It was like she was being hurt and sucked into the ground. Before Gabby could understand what was happening, Carmen's brother and her sister had both dropped to their knees and were also on the floor crying and burying their heads in their hands. Carmen's father held onto the doorframe for a minute, but ended up on the floor with his children. Gabby and I talked about how what we think is a familiar grief, a grief we've come to know and understand and even integrate into our lives, can surprise us again and again, often in the form of anguish. This is especially true when something sparks that shock and that incredulity in us, like the letter that Carmen's mother had written to her. It's often hard to find our way back into our bodies after experiencing anguish. This is why so much effective trauma work today is not only about reclaiming our breath and our feelings and our thinking, but also getting our bones back and returning to our bodies. When we experience anguish and we don't get help or support, we can find it difficult to get up off the floor and re-engage with our lives. We go through the motions, but we're still crumpled. I tried doing that for several months until I realized that I needed to talk to someone to help process that phone call and my anguish. There's another alternative to not addressing the trauma of anguish. We can convince ourselves that we're okay and keep ourselves upright by hanging our crumpling anguish on rigidity and perfectionism and silence, like a wet towel hanging on a rod. We can become closed off, never open to vulnerability and its gifts, and barely existing because anything at any moment could threaten that fragile, rigid scaffolding that's holding up our crumpling selves and keeping us standing. The human spirit is resilient, and just as we can reclaim our ability to breathe and feel and think, we can rebuild the bones that anguish rips away. But it takes time and it takes help. I want to share another example with you about anguish. I don't remember when or where I first saw Dark Elegy, but I know as clear as a bell. I mean, just the day I saw it, I knew I would never forget it, and I haven't. When I started working on this book, I reached out to the artist and asked if I could share her work as an example of anguish, and she generously said yes. So let me tell you a little bit about it. I'll describe it, and you can see the picture on the PDF. And the artist, Susa Ellen Lowenstein, wrote a note about the art for us. Let me read it to you. On December 21st, 1988, while coming home for the holidays, our older son, Alexander, was murdered, along with 258 others aboard Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland. A total of 270 people lost their lives in that terrorist act, 259 aboard the jumbo jet, and 11 on the ground. Alexander was 21 years young. Dark Elegy is made up of 75 larger-than-life pieces, each portraying a mother or wife at that moment when they first heard the awful news of the death of their loved one. What makes this memorial so unique, even more so than the sheer number of pieces or the personal and individual loss each mother portrays, is the fact that it was created by one of those affected, rather than by an outsider portraying someone else's tragedy. I am one of the depicted figures. Although the concept of my sculpture, Dark Elegy, was spawned out of this, my personal tragedy, it has always been dedicated to all the victims of terrorism. So what you'll see when you look at Dark Elegy is a breath-stealing collection of women, mothers, partners, wives, at the moment where they receive the call, all of them crumpled to the ground in some variation, all of them naked. They're all in kind of terracotta and all references to race. They all look the same. And to see it is to just be changed, I think, forever. Dark Elegy is a universal appeal for peace and dignity for all victims of senseless hate and vengeance called terrorism. And the artist meant for this to be a beacon for all peace-loving people. I hope you'll take a minute and take a look at the PDF. I think it's very helpful to see what anguish looks like, because when we bear witness to it, it's so important to understand what we're seeing. And it's so important to understand that the shock and the disbelief and the powerlessness and the pain needs immediate attention. Let's move from anguish to hope, hopelessness and despair. We need hope like we need air. To live without hope is to risk suffocating on hopelessness and despair. It's to risk being crushed by the belief that there's no way out of whatever is holding us back, no way to get to what we desperately need. But hope is not what most of us think it is. It's not a warm, fuzzy emotion that fills us with a sense of possibility. Hope is a way of thinking. It's a cognitive process. Yes, emotions play a role, but hope is made up of what researcher C.R. Schneider called a trilogy of goals, pathways, and agency. Let me break that down for you. We experience hope when we have the ability to set realistic goals. I know where I want to go. When we're able to figure out how to achieve those goals, including the ability to stay flexible and develop alternative pathways. So I know where I want to go and I know how to get there. I'm persistent. I can tolerate disappointment and try new paths again and again. And then agency. We believe in ourselves. I can do this. So let me go through this trilogy of goals, pathways, and agency again, because it's a lot to pull together when you're listening. I can set a goal. I know where I want to go. Pathway, I know how to get there. And look, if I have to plan B it or plan C or D it, I can do that too. And agency, I believe I can do this. Hope is a function of struggle. We develop hope not during the easy or comfortable times, but through adversity and discomfort. Hope is forged when our goals, pathways, and agency are tested and when change is actually possible. So let me say that again because I want you to really get this. Hope is forged when our goals, pathways, and agency are tested and when change is actually possible. We don't build hope when the systems or the things that need to be changed actually can't be moved by us. And unfortunately, there are times when hope is just not sufficient to combat entrenched systemic barriers. It doesn't matter how much hope we have if the deck is stacked or the rules apply to some but not others. That's actually a recipe for hopelessness and despair. We think we should be able to overcome an obstacle. However, the system is rigged, so there's no possible positive outcome. It's really important to know that hope is learned. According to Snyder, children most often learn the habit of hope from their parents. To learn hopefulness, children need relationships that are characterized by boundaries, consistency, and support. Children with high levels of hopefulness have experience with adversity. They've been given the opportunity to struggle, and in doing that, they know how to believe in themselves and their abilities. Look, as someone who struggles watching my kids struggle, I can tell you this is hard. I remind myself of the saying, prepare the child for the path, not the path for the child. One thing that bolsters my personal commitment to letting my kids figure out things on their own, when that's developmentally appropriate and possible, is thinking about the alternatives. You know, when I jump in and fix things, In some way, I'm supporting hopelessness and despair because I'm not giving them that opportunity with adversity. Hopelessness and despair, everything about these words is hard. First, they're both emotions and experiences that can lead to feelings of desperation and can pose serious threats to our well-being. Second, it's really difficult to separate hopelessness and despair and to talk about them as different experiences, yet they are. In the despair research, the word hopeless is often used synonymously with despair, but in the research on hopelessness, we see very few mentions of the concept of despair. It gets so confusing in the academic literature when people use emotion words to describe emotions. So let's see if we can break it down in a helpful way. While hope is not an emotion, hopelessness and despair are both emotions. Hopelessness arises out of a combination of negative life events and negative thought patterns, particularly self-blame and the perceived inability to change our circumstances. Let's look back at C.R. Snyder's work and reverse the trilogy of goals, pathways, and agency to better understand hopelessness. Hopelessness stems from not being able to set realistic goals. We don't know what we want. And even if we can identify realistic goals, we can't figure out how to achieve them. If we attempt to achieve the goals, we give up when we fail, we can't tolerate disappointment, and we can't reset. Last, the agency piece, we don't believe in ourselves or our ability to achieve what we want. Hopelessness is serious. In more than 30 years of research, Aaron Beck and his colleagues have established that experiences of hopelessness are strongly and specifically related to suicide. There are two ways to think about despair and its relationship to hopelessness. Hopelessness can apply to a specific situation, such as feeling hopeless about finishing school or feeling hopeless about our financial future, or to life more generally. Despair, on the other hand, is a sense of hopelessness about a person's entire life and future. When extreme hopelessness seeps into all of the corners of our lives and combines with extreme sadness, we feel despair. Let me read it to you again. So we know hopelessness applies to a specific situation. Money, school, a relationship. Despair is a sense of hopelessness, not about a specific thing, but about our life, our future. When extreme hopelessness seeps into all the corners of our lives and combines with extreme sadness, that's when we feel despair. I once heard theologian Rob Bell define despair as the belief that tomorrow will be just like today. When we're in struggle and are experiencing pain and despair, that belief that there's no end to what we're experiencing is a desperate and claustrophobic feeling. We can't figure a way out of or through the struggle and the suffering. When I look at examples of hope practices in our research, I see commitments to new ways of thinking about what we want to achieve and why. We need to learn how to reality check our goals and the pathways to them and how to take the shame out of having to start over many, many times when our first plan fails. I used to ask my graduate students to submit a semester-long goal at the end of the second week of school. After doing this for years, I knew I could expect 90% of the goals from these students to be unrealistic. Setting realistic goals is a skill and a prerequisite for hope. When we don't have these skills, small disappointments can grow into hopelessness and despair. If we didn't learn hope from our parents, we can still learn it as adults, but it's going to require skill development, support, a therapist, maybe a coach. We all fear pain and struggle, but they're often necessary for growth, and more important, they don't present the level of danger that hopelessness and despair bring us to. We can't ignore hopelessness and despair in ourselves or others. They are both reliable predictors of suicidal thoughts, suicide attempts, and completed suicide, especially when hopelessness is accompanied by emotional pain. In addition to cultivating a hope practice, getting intentional about setting goals, thinking through pathways, and developing a strong belief in ourselves and what we can accomplish, we also need to look to Martin Seligman's research on resilience, especially what many people call his three P's: personalization, permanence, and pervasiveness. I cannot wait to tell y'all about these. These have really been helpful for me, especially around these emotions, around these tough emotions. Let's start with personalization. When we experience despair and hopelessness, we often believe that we are the problem and forget to think about larger issues in context. Self-blame and criticism don't lead to increased hopefulness. They're quicksand. Realizing that outside forces play a role in our struggles can give us a different lens on our experience. The second P is permanence. This one is really important because thinking that our struggle will never end is built into the experiences of despair and hopelessness. This is the "tomorrow will be no different than today" thinking. One way to build resilience is to practice thinking about the temporary nature of most setbacks as part of how we look at adversity on a daily basis. We can't afford to wait to build the skill until we're up against something huge in our lives. It's like building a muscle. You want to do a little bit every day so that when you need that big muscle to activate and help, it's ready. Permanence can be very tough for me, so I've developed a habit of asking myself some questions when I'm scared, worried, overwhelmed, stressed about what's happening. The questions that I ask are, will this issue be a big deal in 5 minutes, in 5 hours, in 5 days, 5 months, 5 years? I've been doing it more often for the last year, especially during the pandemic, and now I try not to sink into fear until I've asked and answered these questions. If nothing else, it pulls my thinking brain online instead of letting my fear brain run the show. Our third P is pervasiveness. Sometimes when we're struggling, we fall into the trap of believing that whatever we're up against has stained or changed every single thing in our life. Nothing good is left. I recently found myself dealing with a crisis at work that, for a moment, felt like the end of the world. I felt as if this thing had swallowed me whole and left nothing behind. Then I got a text that said, "Hey, Mom, do you know where my new goggles are?" The first thing I thought was, aha, the three P's. There's actually a part of my life, the biggest, most important part, in fact, that hasn't even been touched by this. Of course, my second thought was, I definitely need to apologize to my mom for walking past my stack of shit on the bottom of the stairs every day for 17 years. Those goggles have been on the stairs for a week. All right, let's talk about sadness. As I was writing this book, I posted a question on Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter to all of the folks in our social media community. What is your favorite sad movie? At last count, we'd received more than 100,000 enthusiastic responses. The films that came up over and over include, in no particular order, Life is Beautiful, Terms of Endearment, Beaches, The Joy Luck Club, The Color Purple, Steel Magnolias, Brokeback Mountain, P.S. I Love You, Inside Out, Up. And I will tell you this, every movie ever made where a dog dies. I can't even read this list without getting a lump in my throat. I've seen lots of these. In fact, I've seen most of the ones that the people mentioned in the comments. Except I will tell you this, I have not seen the ones where dogs die. I was so caught off guard in fourth grade with Where the Red Fern Grows and Old Yeller, both in the same year. That will never happen to me again. Not only was I curious about the films, I became obsessed with analyzing the descriptors and reasons that people loved their films. People left quotes like "beautifully devastating," "so relatable," "what it means to be human," "I bawl every time I see this, but it's also an incredibly joyful film." "It's been different movies depending on the season of my life," one person commented. "I felt less alone." "I watched this if I need to release some tears." I watch this when I need a good cry. Someone wrote, I don't really like the sadness, but I'm so affected by this movie. Another person wrote, this film is the best in people and the worst. I'm not going to tell you that sadness is wonderful and we need it. I'm going to say that sadness is important and we need it. Feeling sad is a normal response to loss or defeat, or even the perception of loss or defeat. To be human is to know sadness. Owning our sadness is courageous and a necessary step in finding our way back to ourselves and each other. Here are four things I think are important to know about sadness from the research. One, sadness and depression are not the same thing. Sadness is sometimes referred to as a depressed mood. However, sadness is a common but not essential feature of clinical depression. Technically, depression is a cluster of symptoms that persist over a period of time. These symptoms can include lack of interest in pleasant activities, loss of appetite, excessive fatigue and/or insomnia, and difficulty concentrating. Number two, sadness and grief are not the same thing. Although sadness is one part of grief, grief involves a whole group of emotions and experiences, and we'll talk about grief soon. Number three, there are also positive aspects to sadness. Joseph P. Forgas, a professor of psychology at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia, writes, though much has been made of the many benefits of happiness, it's important to consider that sadness can be beneficial too. Sad people are less prone to judgmental errors, are more resistant to eyewitness distortions, are sometimes more motivated, and are more sensitive to social norms. They can act with more generosity too. Forgas goes on to explain, quote, evolutionary theory suggests that we should embrace all of our emotions as each has an important role to play under the right circumstances. So though you may seek ways to increase happiness, don't haphazardly push away your sadness. No doubt it's there for a good reason. Additionally, some scholars have speculated that one function of sadness is to cause the person to evaluate their life and consider making changes in their circumstances following a negative event, as well as to recruit help and support from others. My research has taught me that acknowledging and naming our own sadness is critical in the formation of compassion and empathy. In our saddest moments, we want to be held by or feel connected to someone who has known that same ache, even if what caused it is completely different. We don't want our sadness overlooked or diminished by someone who can't tolerate what we're feeling because they're unwilling or unable to own their own sadness. The fourth thing that I think it's important to understand is why we love sad movies. A research team led by Julian Honig investigated the sad film paradox. How can a negative emotion such as sadness go together with aesthetic liking and even pleasure? Their findings totally align with the 100,000 plus comments from our community. We like to be moved. We like to feel connected to what it means to be human, to be reminded of our inextricable connection to one another. Sadness moves the individual us toward the collective us. Their study revealed a, quote, highly significant positive correlation between sadness and enjoyment. However, the association is sequential. Sadness leads to feeling moved, which in turn leads to enjoyment. Quote, hence sadness primarily functions as a contributor to an intensifier of the emotional state of being moved. If we think back to that list of movies, they are moving. I felt deeply moved by them. Okay, let's talk about one of the most complex and important and universal emotions that we experience, grief. I open up this section on grief with a quote by Elizabeth Gilbert. Liz writes, grief does not obey your plans or your wishes. Grief will do whatever it wants to you, whenever it wants to. In that regard, grief has a lot in common with love. Grief is often thought of as a process that includes many emotions rather than a singular emotion. For a long time, we thought about the grief process in terms of linear stages. But almost all of the recent research actually refutes the idea that grief progresses in predictable or sequenced stages. Robert A. Niemeyer, a psychology professor at the University of Memphis and a clinician, is one of the world's most prolific grief researchers. I often share his work with professionals looking for training in grief work and with individuals who are grieving. Niemeyer writes, quote, "A central process in grieving is the attempt to reaffirm or reconstruct a world of meaning that has been challenged by loss." In my research, three foundational elements of grief emerged from the data: loss, longing, and feeling lost. Let's look at each of those. Loss. While death and separation are tangible losses associated with grief, some of the participants described losses that are more difficult to identify or describe. These included the loss of normality, the loss of what could be, the loss of what we thought we knew or understood about something or someone. The next is longing, and this is related to loss. Longing is not a conscious wanting. It's an involuntary yearning for wholeness, for understanding, for meaning, for the opportunity to regain or simply even touch what we've lost. Longing is a vital and important part of grief. Yet many of us feel we need to keep our longings to ourselves for fear we'll be misunderstood, perceived as engaging in magical or unrealistic thinking, or lacking in fortitude and resilience. The last is feeling lost. Grief requires us to reorient every part of our physical, emotional, and social worlds. When we imagine the need to do this, most of us picture the painful struggle to adjust to a tangible change, such as someone dying or moving away. But this is a very limited view of grief. The more difficult it is for us to articulate our experiences of loss, longing, and feeling lost to the people around us, the more disconnected and alone we feel. Talking about grief is difficult in a world that wants us to get over it, or a community that's quick to pathologize grief. The Center for Complicated Grief at Columbia is another tremendous resource. Their definitions are very helpful when thinking about grief. I think the most important line is, quote, "When a person adapts to a loss, grief is not over." It doesn't mean that we're sad the rest of our lives. It means that grief finds a place in our lives. Imagine a world in which we honor that place in ourselves and others, rather than hiding it, ignoring it, or pretending it doesn't exist because of fear or shame. I keep thinking back to a conversation I had on Unlocking Us with the grief expert David Kessler. I'll never forget him saying this, quote, "Each person's grief is as unique as their fingerprint. But what everyone has in common is that no matter how they grieve, they share a need for their grief to be witnessed." That doesn't mean needing someone to try to lessen it or reframe it for them. The need is for someone to be fully present to the magnitude of their loss without trying to point out the silver lining. Professor Niemeyer's work supports this need for real connection and healing. He writes, quote, "Most people who struggle with complicating loss feel a great press to tell the story, to find someone willing to hear what others cannot, and who can join them in making sense of the death without withdrawing into awkward silence or offering trite and superficial advice regarding the questions it poses." This need for connection, for storytelling and story catching, is what makes group therapy and support groups such powerful healing experiences for those who are grieving. Working through complicated grief, however, requires a mental health professional with training in complicated grief work. Before we leave grief, I want to share some definitions that I share in the book. The first three are from the Center for Complicated Grief. And I think it's helpful to understand there are so many different types of grief. Not only are there a million different ways to work through grief and process grief, there are actually different types of grief. So we have acute grief, which occurs in the initial period after a loss. It almost always includes strong feelings of yearning, longing, and sadness, along with anxiety, bitterness, anger, remorse, guilt, and sometimes shame. Thoughts are mostly focused on the person who died, and it can be difficult to concentrate on anything else. Acute grief dominates a person's life. Then there's integrated grief. This is the result of adapting to the loss. When a person adapts to a loss, grief is not over. Instead, thoughts, feelings, and behaviors related to their loss are integrated in ways that allow them to remember and honor the person who died. Grief finds a place in their life. So complicated grief occurs when something interferes with adaptation. When this happens, acute grief can persist for a very long period of time. A person with complicated grief feels intense emotional pain. They can't stop feeling that their loved one might somehow reappear, and they don't see a way forward. A future without their loved one seems forever dismal and unappealing. Grief dominates their thoughts and feelings with no respite in sight. Relationships with family and friends flounder. Life can seem purposeless, as if nothing matters without their loved one. Others can begin to feel frustrated, helpless, and discouraged. Even professionals may be uncertain about how to help. People often think this is depression, but complicated grief and depression are not the same thing. And you remember that I just read earlier that complicated grief requires professional helping, and specifically, it requires finding someone who's trained in complicated grief. The last one is disenfranchised grief, based on the research of Tachelle Bourdier. Disenfranchised grief is a less studied form of grief, grief that is not openly acknowledged or publicly supported through mourning practices or rituals because the experience is not valued or counted by others as a loss. The grief can also be invisible or hard to see by others. Examples of disenfranchised grief include loss of a partner or parent due to divorce, the loss of an unborn child and/or infertility, the multitude of losses experienced by a survivor of sexual assault, and the loss of a loved one to suicide. As an illustrative example of disenfranchised grief, Tachelle Bourdier explains that sexual assault survivors suffer from numerous losses, many of which are invisible to others. Some of those losses include loss of one's prior worldview, loss of trust, loss of self-identity and self-esteem, loss of freedom and independence, loss of a sense of safety and security, and even a loss of sexual interest. I think the thing that we need to take from this last piece on grief before we move into chapter 7 is the complexity of feeling grief, of processing grief, and the different types of grief. We live in a culture where we don't tolerate grief in ourselves and other people. And one way I think that we can start to do that is to better understand it and better understand that to be human is to know grief. We're all going to experience it. We all have experienced it. And the more we understand it and name it, the more we can talk about it and ask for the support we need. Chapter 7, Places We Go With Others. Compassion, pity, empathy, sympathy, boundaries, comparative suffering. Let's start with compassion and empathy. Across the research and clinical practice community, there are compelling debates happening right now about the role that compassion and empathy play in how we connect with people who are struggling. Some people argue that compassion is the best response. Some people argue that it's empathy. And some people think we need both for different reasons. Everyone is trying to answer this question. What's the most effective way to be in connection with and in service to someone who is struggling without taking on their issues as our own? It's an important debate that is frustratingly hijacked on occasion by folks who come up with new, arbitrary definitions for emotions that are completely different from how we all use the terms. They change the meaning, then argue that the emotion is bad based on their new definition. For example, someone might say, empathy is taking on all the feelings of another person, then argue that empathy is bad. Unfortunately, this approach is often misleading and self-serving and puts no value on how we use the word. I would argue that a lot of this linguistic shell gaming is about wanting to be contrarian. There's nothing more seductive and clickable than a discovery that something we believe to be good is bad. For example, empathy is bad for you. When it comes to language, I'm a populist. How we, the collective, use language matters as much as, if not more than, arbitrary definitions that don't center lived experience. If research is going to serve people, it has to reflect their experiences. There are significant differences between compassion and empathy that are vital to understand if we want to cultivate connection with others. There are also different definitions and types of empathy. I'm going to try to sort it out here using a combination of our research and research being done by other experts in the field. Let's start by digging into the relationship between compassion and empathy. Here's what I've learned. Compassion is a daily practice, and empathy is a skill set that is one of the most powerful tools of compassion. The most effective approach to meaningful connection combines compassion with a very specific type of empathy called cognitive empathy. Let's get into it. Our working definition of compassion first emerged from the data about 10 years ago. It's been revised over time, but the core has remained the same, and it has stood the test of new data. Here's the definition. Compassion is the daily practice of recognizing and accepting our shared humanity so that we treat ourselves and others with loving kindness, and we take action in the face of suffering. A very similar definition can be found in the research literature. For example, compassion is a virtuous response that seeks to address the suffering and needs of a person through relational understanding and action. What the majority of definitions share, including these, is that compassion includes action. It's not just feeling, it's doing. Compassion is fueled by understanding and accepting that we're all made of strength and struggle. No one is immune to pain or suffering. Compassion is not a practice of I'm better than or I can fix you. It's a practice based in the beauty and pain of shared humanity. In her book, The Places That Scare You, the American Buddhist nun Pema Chodron writes, "When we practice generating compassion, we can expect to experience our fear of pain. Compassion practice is daring. It involves learning to relax and allow ourselves to move gently toward what scares us. In cultivating compassion, we draw from the wholeness of our experience, our suffering, our empathy, as well as our cruelty and terror. It has to be this way. Compassion is not a relationship between the healer and the wounded. It's a relationship between equals. Only when we know our own darkness well can we be present with the darkness of others. Compassion becomes real when we recognize our shared humanity." I just love this quote. I mean, it's so powerful. This paragraph completely rearranged my parenting approach. I went from always wanting to fix things and make them better to literally sitting in the dark with my kids. Before I fully understood that the action part of compassion wasn't making things better or fixing, I would race to flip on the metaphorical lights when my kids were suffering. Now I try to sit with them in the dark and show them how to feel the discomfort. Talking about moving gently toward what scares us, it's so painful. But now that I've been doing it for probably the past decade, I can see how my kids are developing that sense of shared humanity. I've even had the incredible fortune of witnessing them moving toward others in pain without trying to solve. But I'm not going to lie, it is really hard. Sitting in the dark with them is not one bit easier in the moment than it was 10 years ago. Everything in my body is screaming, make it better, fix it. Maybe this is an example, actually, of how understanding emotion can be a life raft in a sea of turbulent feelings. Sometimes I have to desperately cling to what I know rather than act on what I'm feeling in the moment. Let's talk about pity. While compassion is not rescuing, it's also not pity. In fact, pity is the near enemy of compassion. I want y'all to hold this concept of near enemy close and listen to how it's defined, because it's going to be a huge part of the last section of the book. In her book, Fierce Self-Compassion, University of Texas researcher Kristen Neff writes, near enemy is a useful Buddhist concept referring to a state of mind that appears similar to the desired state, hence it's near, but actually undermines it, which is why it's an enemy. So far enemies are the opposite of emotions or experiences. The far enemy of compassion might be cruelty. What's interesting is that near enemies are often greater threats than far enemies because they're much more difficult to recognize. As we build our understanding of emotion and experiences, the concept of near enemy is invaluable. To better understand how it works, let's look at compassion and pity. In Bringing Home the Dharma, Jack Kornfield writes, the near enemy of compassion is pity. Instead of feeling the openness of compassion, pity says, oh, that poor person. I feel sorry for people like that. Pity sees them as different from ourselves. It sets up a separation between ourselves and others, a sense of distance and remoteness from the suffering of others that is affirming and gratifying to the self. Compassion, on the other hand, recognizes the suffering of another as a reflection of our own pain. I understand this. I suffer in the same way. It is empathetic, a mutual connection with the pain and sorrow of life. Compassion is shared suffering. I think there's nothing worse than feeling pitied, and we have the research actually to show us why it feels so isolating. Pity involves four elements: a belief that the suffering person is inferior, a passive, self-focused reaction that does not include providing help, a desire to maintain emotional distance, and avoidance of sharing in the other person's suffering. And addressing the big question about being with people without taking on their pain, Kornfield goes on to say, another enemy of compassion is despair. Compassion does not mean immersing ourselves in the suffering of others to the point of anguish. Compassion is the tender readiness of the heart to respond to one's own or another's pain without despair, resentment, or aversion. It is the wish to dissipate suffering. Compassion embraces those experiencing sorrow and eliminates cruelty from the mind. We're going to get into empathy now, which is the most powerful tool of compassion. It's an emotional skill set that allows us to understand what someone is experiencing and to reflect back that understanding. Empathy has a huge upside. Researchers Peter Paul Zurich and Herbert Scheithauer explain that empathy helps interpersonal decision-making, facilitates ethical decision-making and moral judgments, enhances short-term subjective well-being, strengthens relational bonds, allows people to better understand how others see them, and enhances pro-social and altruistic behavior. Most researchers agree that there are at least two elements to empathy, cognitive empathy and affective empathy. Cognitive empathy, sometimes called perspective taking or mentalizing, is the ability to recognize and understand another person's emotions. Affective empathy, often called experience sharing, is one's own emotional attunement with another person's experience. Based on my work, I believe meaningful connection requires a combination of compassion and cognitive empathy or perspective taking. In simple terms, the empathy I'm talking about is understanding what someone is feeling, not feeling it for them. If someone is feeling lonely, empathy doesn't require us to feel lonely too, only to reach back into our own experience with loneliness so we can understand and connect. Affective empathy, feeling something along with the person who is struggling, is a slippery slope toward becoming overwhelmed and not being able to offer meaningful support. There are several models of and theories on empathy, but the one that aligns the most closely with our data is Teresa Weisman's research. She studied empathy across helping professions and developed four attributes. We, based on our data, added a fifth attribute from Kristen Neff, whose work on self-compassion has been a life changer for me. Teresa Weisman's attributes of empathy include 1, perspective taking. What does that concept mean for you? What is that experience like for you? 2, staying out of judgment. Just listen, don't put value on it. 3, recognizing emotion. How can I touch within myself something that helps me identify and connect with what the other person might be feeling? Check in and clarify what you're hearing. Ask questions. 4, communicating our understanding about the emotion. Sometimes this is elaborate and detailed, and sometimes this is simply, oh, shit, that's hard. I get that. And the last one, the one we added from Kristen Neff, is mindfulness. It's simply not pushing away emotion because it's uncomfortable, but feeling it and moving through it. Again, empathy is a tool of compassion. We can respond empathically only if we are willing to be present to someone's pain. If we're not willing to do that, it's just not real empathy. A few researchers argue that empathy is a skill set that can be used to hurt people as well as in the service of compassion. I disagree. If you're connecting to how I feel so you can leverage my emotions, we shouldn't call that empathy. It makes no sense. We should call that manipulation or exploitation. Language matters. Don't use a word that has an almost universally positive connotation to describe a dangerous behavior that's hurtful. Use a word that is